The social media megalopolis that is Facebook is upsetting some of its denizens this week. Facebook rolled out a new program to connect users with businesses and other interests that may want access to information about likes and dislikes, friends of friends, and other odds and ends. Many people see this as an invasion of privacy and want to know how to opt out. Well, we've brought in Andy Carvin. He tracks social media here at NPR, and he's going to help us out with this. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
So first, what is it that Facebook has done this week, and why did they make this change?
Well, for a long time, people would use Facebook simply for networking with friends and family and colleagues, and you'd share certain things, such as websites you'd like, music you liked, you'd talk about different things that were going on in the world, and it was generally considered you'd be talking among yourselves. But what Facebook has done is they've started revealing a large chunk of this information to the entire world. So, for example, if you went to a news website and decided that you liked a particular article and you wanted to acknowledge that on your Facebook profile, or you liked a new book that came out, that would now be very, very public. And so some of the partners Facebook launched with, when you go to their websites now, it'll show you all of your friends who have liked certain things on their website. Doesn't matter if you've gone to Washington Post before, for example, or Yelp.com. When you go see it now, even without having to sign in, it's suddenly showing you all of your friends' Facebook activities, and they would see the same thing of you as well. And so on the one hand, it's seen as an interesting way to get a feel for what all your friends are doing, but it's also creeping out a lot of folks who aren't expecting it and raising a lot of privacy questions.
Feels like eavesdropping.
A bit of eavesdropping, even though people on Facebook have shared information with each other for a long time. Facebook continues to peel things open further and further and further, and often without much warning to people. And one of the big complaints a lot of folks have had, including several members of the Senate, is that there isn't a way to opt in. Instead, it's automatic. It's happening for you immediately.
And so there's no notice.
There's no real notice except when you go to Facebook and said, oh, by the way, we changed the privacy rules, so you now have to go and opt out of it manually. And if you don't take that step manually, all of this stuff is going to be out there in the ether.
So businesses ideally might get better information. Facebook gets money out of this deal?
Well, over time, they certainly will, because what they're doing is monetizing all the things that a person likes, all the relationships they have, all the activities they do, and that's worth a lot of money to marketers.
So a little bit of news that you can use. If you do decide that you want to opt out of this, how do you do it?
What you want to do is the next time you're on the Facebook homepage, click that button in the top right corner where it says Account, and there's a little drop-down menu that'll appear, and one of the items will be Privacy Settings. Just go in there and poke around, and it'll explain to you, hopefully in plain English, what you need to do. Meanwhile, a number of the sites that they've partnered with, when you go there for the first time, there will be a notice at the top of the page telling you that they've done this, and it'll have directions on how to opt out as well.
Andy, I understand that you're going to have information on our website on how people can actually opt out. A little bit more information if they didn't understand here. You can go to our website at NPR.org.
Yes, NPR.org. Go to our blog, All Tech Considered, and we'll have it all laid out for you.
Perfect. Andy Carvin tracks social media for us here at NPR.org.
Now, in a rare move, Steve Jobs published a letter attacking another technology company. The target of his wrath was Adobe, which makes Flash animation software. Flash is what animates most of the web, but Apple has refused to put the software on its iPhone and iPad. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
If you're a Rihanna fan and you go to her MySpace page on your computer, this is what you hear. Tonight I'ma let you be the captain. But if you go to the site with your iPad or your iPhone, you hear nothing. That's because these devices don't use Flash. According to Adobe, which makes Flash, about 75% of all video on the web is Flash-based. YouTube works on iPhones and iPads because they have designed non-Flash apps. A lot of consumers and various corporations have complained to Apple about the lack of Flash. Yesterday, in a harshly worded letter, Steve Jobs lashed out at the technology. He claimed it sucked battery life, caused devices to crash, and was too oriented to the personal computer to work on mobile devices. Jeff Hammond, an analyst at Forrester Research, says for the moment, Apple is the bright star of the mobile market. But its refusal to use Flash may eventually give an edge to competition from mobile devices that use Windows software or Google's Android.
Developers will run to the platforms that are the most open, that give them the most choice, the most flexibility, the most capacity to innovate.
In a recent statement, Adobe said it was committed to bringing Flash to any platform with a screen. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
There are mother-daughter book clubs for empty nesters, book clubs for single women and for fans of Oprah Winfrey. And now NPR's Laura Seidel reports on an effort to get millions of people to discuss a novel on Twitter, 140 characters at a time.
It's called One Book, One Twitter, and the idea comes from Jeff Howe. Howe, a contributing editor at Wired magazine, wasn't actually looking to online book clubs as the model. He was inspired by One Book, One Chicago. Back in 2001, the entire city read To Kill a Mockingbird.
You had, you know, elementary school kids reading it, and their parents reading it, and their grandparents reading it, and black people reading it, Hispanic people reading it, white people reading it, rich and poor. And it gave all these people with very little in common at least one thing in common.
Since then, other cities have done the same thing. Now, Howe is bringing it to Twitter.
We can't make the Sunni love Shia. We can't turn red states and blue states into the United States. But what we can do is all read the same book together and get to know one another a little bit.
Howe wrote his idea in an article in Wired magazine, and he began tweeting about it. Andrea Grover, an independent curator and writer who lives in Houston, is going to be a reader. To her, it feels like other collaborations she's done with artists on Flickr.
What came out of that is I now have friends in Pakistan and Iran and have meaningful relationships that developed offline. Twitter might just be the gateway to something deeper.
Of course, this raises the question of how deep can the comments be when they have to fit into the 140-character limit on Twitter. Howe thinks you can say a lot.
I'm a big defender of Twitter as having given rise to a renaissance of the epigrammatic form. And so I think it's possibly very insightful in 140 characters.
We decided to ask an expert on condensing great novels into few words. Susan Von Kirk wrote the cliff notes for The Scarlet Letter. She gave us her Twitter version.
Sin is bad, confession good. Courageous Hester wears A and lives. Cowardly Dimmesdale won't and dies. Puritans satisfied, H and D together in death.
It's 140 characters, but Von Kirk admits it's not very deep. She actually is a little skeptical about a discussion on Twitter in 140-character notes.
It's very difficult to condense and to put your thoughts down, even about the book. It's really tough to do that in, say, 70 pages. Let alone 140 characters.
Thousands of One Book, One Twitter participants just picked from a list of 10 finalists for the big read. And it wasn't shallow stuff. Among them was Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, Arundhati Roy's God of Small Things, American Gods by sci-fi superstar Neil Gaiman. American Gods won. Bill Drew from upstate New York voted for it. He admits he's not sure he'll be able to say much in 140 characters, but he might entice people to go further.
You can start out with something that's going to grab them and have a link that points to more.
Organizer Jeff Howe says he plans to ask everyone to read a chapter a week. He hopes it feels a little like being at a big party.
This is a big room with a lot of people who are all reading the same chapter, and they're very excited, and they're speaking in short, incisive bursts.
Well, hopefully they'll be. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll talk about the offshore wind farms and the future of them. But first, remember in the old days when you had a problem with your car, you could pop the hood, bang on the carburetor, maybe jiggle the starter. I know people who hit it with golf clubs to get it to start. Well, these days, those days are fading into baby boomer memories because these days more and more of our car functions are controlled by electronics. Starter buttons are replacing keys. The throttle may be hooked to a chip instead of a cable. Features like stability control, automatic parallel parking, I mean even more electronics and software under the hood. Many of these innovations have improved safety and fuel economy, but some critics are wondering if these electronics are becoming too complex or if bugs in the system are leading to safety problems. Earlier this month, Lexus voluntarily recalled 9,000-plus Lexus GX460s after the car testers at Consumer Reports showed that faulty software in the vehicles could lead to rollover accidents. NASA and the National Academy of Sciences are going to be investigating other Toyota vehicles to see whether faulty electronics might be at the root of the unintended acceleration problems. So just how much of our cars are controlled by electronics? I don't know. Should we be worried about that? Somebody who has looked into that is Ingolf Kruger. He's a professor of computer science at the University of California, San Diego, and directs the university's software and systems engineering laboratory there. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Kruger.
Thanks for having me.
I know you aren't involved in the Toyota investigations, but could electronics be the blame there?
We cannot rule it out. The accidents that we've seen in the context of the Toyota and unintended acceleration problems are very multifaceted. So any car system is both an electronic system and a mechanical system, as you know. And then we have the driver and passengers also involved in the overall system car, if you will. And so any investigation will have to look at the full spectrum of possibilities ranging from the mechanical to the electric and the electronics components and the overall environment with the driver.
Don't they have a black box in them like airplanes have?
You would be surprised to know that actually starting with 2005 roughly, more and more of these black boxes have found their way into the car, and they record short bursts of information before the airbag goes off or before a crash is detected. But the information that is recorded is fairly little. If you think about the whole set of events that can lead up to an electronic glitch, so it's very difficult to have a, even with a black box in a car, to have the full spectrum of information available that you need to reconstruct the accident.
When you say a whole sequence of events, give us an idea of what you're talking about.
In a typical car today, you have on the order of 80 electronic control units in the luxury segment, and if you're in the mid-range segment, you have anywhere between 15 to 30 to 55 electronic control units. And they have thousands of software functions which aggregate to offer about 200 to 300 functions that the driver is using.
Wow.
Let's look at an example, central locking system or your stability control. Both of these actually combine electronic features from multiple computers to deliver the functions that the driver and passenger expects. And it is all of these functions communicate over the networks that are in the car. In the upper segment, you have five different types of networks that all transport the information from one electronic box to another electronic box. And so you have to look at the entire spectrum of events that happen in these interactions to see whether there's a condition that leads to an accident, for instance.
And so if the black box only records a very small time segment, you may never know, given the complexity of all of this.
You may never know. And so if you think about it, once you switch off your vehicle, most of the fleeting information that sits on these electronic networks is lost. There's a little bit of information left in each of the electronic control units, and that's what the investigators surely are looking at to find out what states these electronic control units, the little computers that sit in your car, have recorded. But to reconstruct all of the events that led up to the incident is very difficult. You have to look ultimately into the code of the software that sits on these computers, and even then you may not be able to reconstruct all the event sequences that lead up to the incident.
So it's up to the car companies themselves, because the code they use is priority. It's a priority code that's in there.
Yes.
And it's not open to anybody else to look at and say, here's a problem.
Yeah, right. And you also have to understand basically the whole business of automotive, because automotive companies rely on a multi-tiered system of suppliers who deliver the individual boxes, including the software and the electronics, to the car manufacturer, who then ultimately becomes a system integrator and takes these boxes and the electronics and integrates them, makes them work together so that the vehicle ultimately can drive.
Hmm.
And so many car companies have a limited purview into what the actual software code is. Of course, if they want to, they can look into it. But there's a lot of intellectual property that sits also with the multi-tiered supplier base. And that is understandable because a lot of the innovations come today from software in the vehicle. So there's a lot of intellectual property that sits in the software and has the innovations that we like, such as assisted parking, for instance.
Right, like the parking. I've seen some cars now that will detect when you're getting too close to other cars, right?
Right.
Sideways, front ways.
Right, right.
And that's their competitive advantage, is keeping
Correct.
That software and hardware secret.
Yes, and you see always this these functions travel from the luxury segment via the mid-range segment to the lower end of the cost segment in the vehicle.
What about electronic interference from outside? You mentioned the systems in the car. More of these cars are having, we have Wi-Fi in them, and we're going to have satellite systems, things like that. Can they cause electromagnetic interference?
Electromagnetic interference is and has been a problem in cars that both the suppliers and the car manufacturers address already for decades. Because simply the coexistence of many electromagnetic devices in the car has required them to build shielding around these electronic control units to prevent this interference from occurring. And I'm not a statistician, but if the cosmic rays or aliens were the cause, I think we would know more about it.
We would. Yeah, we might look at their systems.
Yeah.
It's almost impossible. It's getting impossible to buy a car that doesn't have, you know, you can try to get as cheap as you want in some of the cars, but they're getting installed. And if you don't like technology, to not
right.
have these things in there. But the car companies are saying that these make the cars safer when they're working.
Correct. Not only safer, I mean, you have to look at saving energy, reducing emissions, and, of course, improving safety. And all of this is happening to a large degree because of software, because of electronics in the vehicles. So, for instance, the stability control systems that are now again in the news, if you will, they are attributed to a reduction of about 26 to 46% of single car accidents. Fatal single-car accidents after they were introduced into the car lineups.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a significant contribution to safety. Much of the unintended acceleration, as grave as it is, has not changed that statistics, if you will.
Well, we have other examples of safety. I remember there was a case about an airbag going off.
Yes. This is a case from Europe about 10 years ago or so. There was problems in the software of an airbag controller where a baby was actually killed by an airbag that shouldn't have gone off because the parents had the airbag controller for the side or passenger airbag switched off by a dealership. And because of a software glitch, that passenger side airbag went off, the rear-mounted baby was killed in the process.
Mm-hmm. So where do you see this? Where should it be heading, all these innovations and the safety?
Where it should be heading is hard to tell. I mean, it will be heading towards even increased electronics in the car. And this is for a very simple reason. We will have to be even more fuel efficient in the future. We'll have to be more environmentally conscious. And we will see much more interaction between the vehicles themselves to reduce the congestion, but also between the vehicles and the infrastructure to have guided driving. And ultimately, we'll see interactions between the car and dealerships so that they can observe problems ahead of time.
You know, all the airplanes, FAA system is controlled by the FAA, and things have to pass muster and things have to be tested. If cars are going to be as complex as airplanes, shouldn't we have testing, you know, government testing bureaus to make sure that the software and hardware is working too?
That's an interesting idea, and it is being pondered. We will have a similar thing ultimately as we see it in airplanes and as we see it on railroad systems. However, you have to also consider the cost margins that are very different in the automotive domain and in the other mentioned domains. Airplanes cost per unit much more than an individual car, and tiny savings in the automotive domain with multiple million cars sold have a huge impact, of course, on jobs and lost or not lost or saved and hires you can make. And therefore, the cost margins are very different, and you have to consider this in your analysis of whether we would have to have government regulation there.
Well, of course, all that goes out the window when we have a death or an airplane crash.
Absolutely.
And then not only the lives that are lost, but the what happens to the reputation of the company.
Exactly.
Gets factored in.
And that's what we're seeing with the current events. We have about 9 million Toyotas recalled right now, and we see an impact on how the brand is perceived, of course.
Yeah. Dr. Kroger, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much again for having me.
You're welcome. Ingolf Kroger is a professor of computer science at the University of California, San Diego, where he directs the University Software and Systems Engineering Laboratory.
If you're sick of hearing about the iPad or the iPhone or anything with a lowercase I in front of it, well, apologies, because this next story is kind of about that. People who surf the web with these devices sometimes come across huge chunks of empty space where a video or a game should go. It's because Apple's mobile products don't support Flash. That's the technology that powers those parts of the web. Now, Apple's CEO, Steve Jobs, hates Flash. He even released an open letter Thursday explaining why. And because his iDevices don't support Flash, he's got some of the Internet's most popular destinations, the New York Times, Facebook, even us at NPR.org, working to strip Flash away from their websites. This isn't the first time Apple's taken aim at a mainstream technology, and Leander Caney has chronicled that history. He's the author of a number of books about Apple, including the Steve Jobs biography, Inside Steve's Brain, and he runs the website cultofmac.com. Leander Caney, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
So why doesn't Steve Jobs at Apple like Flash? What does he have against it?
It's purely technical. It's not a very good program for mobile devices. It's CPU hog, and it drains battery life very quickly. So he doesn't want it on it.
I mean, let's just put it into perspective. Flash is the dominant multimedia technology out there right now, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It has amazing penetration. You know, most three-quarters of all the video on the net is encoded in Flash. Almost all of the games, all the casual games, especially the really popular games like Farmville and Facebook, they're all encoded in Flash. Almost all of the technology world is in bed with Flash. Almost all of it. It's kind of remarkable.
Now, if you go to the NPR website, for example, on your internet browser, the videos that you might see there, or the New York Times website, for example, are made using Flash. But if you use your iPad or your iPhone, you can still see the videos. NPR has essentially removed Flash for those mobile devices. I mean, that seems like Apple has a lot of power to push these kinds of changes.
Oh, absolutely, yes. It really does have a lot of power. It's quite remarkable. I spoke to one expert, and he said that 6 months ago he thought Flash was the future. He thought Flash had was the future of multimedia on the net. He says these days he thinks it's doomed.
Apple is often credited with being one of the driving forces, you know, sort of popularizing new technology like the mouse, but also helping to kill off other technologies. What are some other examples of things that Apple has sort of basically moved away from that have then gone off to die?
The floppy drive was a good example. In the late 90s when Steve Jobs introduced the first iMac. It came without a floppy drive. It had this new thing called a CD drive.
And that was the end of the floppy drive.
It was, yeah. Yeah, it was definitely the end of the floppy for most people.
And, of course, iTunes and the iPod are effectively, if they haven't already, basically killed the CD.
Right, absolutely. And another good example is even Blu-ray. There's been a lot of controversy about the lack of Blu-ray drives in its Macintosh computers, but Apple says you can already get a lot of really high-def content streaming over the internet. And, of course, this is where, you know, everyone knows that this is where it's eventually going to go, but they're pushing that envelope already.
Is there anything about this that suggests it is about power?
I don't think so. Jobs is a very curious character because he is so private. A lot of people love to think of him as this sort of cat-stroking villain in a volcano lair who is hatching evil plans. but I think he is genuinely interested in crafting technology that is easy to use for consumers. And Flash wrecks that experience, or has the potential to wreck that experience. And so it's gone. He's just extremely ruthless about that.
That's Leander Caney. He runs the website cultofmac.com. We spoke with him from KQED in San Francisco. Leander Caney, thanks so much.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. English is the Internet's dominant language. It's used by more than a quarter of those who go online. But Chinese seems certain to surpass English within a few years, and dozens of other languages are experiencing huge growth. Mark Phillips of NPR's On the Media set out to explore the language barriers that are forming in cyberspace and the tools that are being developed to overcome them.
The Internet started as a project by the U.S. military and then grew with the help of American universities. Many of the earliest big Internet startups were also U.S.-based. And that's why
there's been this sense that English is the default language on the Internet.
Ethan Zuckerman, co-founder of the multilingual blog network Global Voices, says Internet users all over the world used English, and that at first it had a big upside.
Things were easier. It was easier to have the sense that we were all in the same conversation, that we were all laughing at the same jokes. A common language is a first step towards communication across cultural boundaries.
But non-English growth on the web is skyrocketing. Better access to computers and internet connections around the globe have allowed hundreds of millions of new users to get online. And with so many signing on, communities of bloggers, message boards, and news sites can write in their native languages. Arabic internet users, for example, have increased by over 2,000% over the past decade. Ethan Zuckerman says this is mostly very good news, but
the one big negative is that it introduces this huge source of fragmentation. Lots of separate internets. And they're separated by a couple of different things. But language is the big one. And language is the one that turns out to be hardest to overcome.
Many internet developers hope that translation software can overcome that age-old language barrier and make all the content on the web available to everyone. The idea dates back to World War II, and while there are many machine translating systems, one of the most promising right now is Google Translate. Michael Galvez, a project manager at Google Translate, says Google's advantage comes from harnessing unprecedented amounts of data.
What we do is we actually use hundreds of billions of words that Google infrastructure has access to. This is actually scoured from the web.
It's a two-step process. First, Google pulls in all the text, recognizes the language, and creates what it calls a language model. There's one for each of the 52 languages available on the service. The language model gives Google Translate a feel for the language. For example, it knows the sentence, "The boy are sad," is very rare, just as a 5-year-old knows that sounds weird. But the language model only teaches the computer how to speak each language by itself. The next step is to translate from one language to another. Google's Michael Galvez says, for that,
we also build what's called a translation model using previous human translation that we have access to, documents from the EU, the United Nations, very high-quality translation corpora.
This translation model allows Google's computers to move between multiple languages. Paired with the language model, it produces startlingly accurate results. Plug in an article from a Spanish-language newspaper, and it reads like an English article that just needs a trip to the copy editor. And because it's based on what people actually write on the web, it can deal with mistakes.
So, for example, instead of spelling receive with the E before I, transpose the I and the E, and you translate this into Spanish, it will actually translate this correctly.
Huh, yeah.
It even knows what to do with slang, like the abbreviation for laugh out loud.
I just typed in LOL, and that's ha 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 with a J.
Yes, so it found LOL. Yeah. In Spanish, it's ha 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 with a J, yeah.
But Google Translate is limited. Often it communicates the gist without the all-important context. Sometimes it makes no sense at all.
The solution isn't machine translation just getting better or human translators just getting more pervasive. The solution is some combination of the two.
blogger Ethan Zuckerman.
We're doing a much, much better job of figuring out how to organize these communities of human translators, take advantage of people's willingness to volunteer, willingness to work for small sums of money through a system like Mechanical Turk.
A new website called Medan.net is an example of this kind of project. It translates stories about the Arab world from both English and Arab media. The short posts on its homepage are always translated by a person.
The idea is a Wikipedia-style approach to translation.
Medan's founder, Ed Bice.
Any registered translator on our system, and we now have about 1,000 people who are capable of generating translations on Medan, can contribute to improving a translation.
But Medan's signature innovation is how it presents the translations. The usual way is to put a toggle button at the top of the webpage where you choose your language. Click on English, and all the Arabic on the page disappears. This is how Google Translate works. But Ed Bice says Medan puts both languages side by side.
Page right is Arabic, which conveniently it's a right-to-left language, and we have page left, English. And kind of having that visual cue, you can actually see this cross-language conversation happening on the website.
You immediately see a ping-pong back and forth between the two languages. On Medan, a two-sentence story about a Syrian man throwing his shoe at the Turkish prime minister generated 26 comments. The first two were originally in English, then two from Arabic, then five that were originally in English, and so on. At first, the two languages have separate conversations. But as the thread continues, the conversations merge to create a cross-cultural discussion about the meaning of shoe throwing.
There are two narratives that describe almost any emerging situation or policy decision regarding the U.S. and the Middle East. And the most obvious dividing line for those narratives is linguistic.
So if sites like Medan put these two narratives side by side and translate them, will a third narrative emerge? Will our differences dissolve and world peace reign? Maybe in the long run, says Ethan Zuckerman.
In the short run, actually, it could be very, very difficult. When you can read what people say in their own languages, it's often a lot less diplomatic and a lot more nationalistic. As we get better and better and better at translating, I think what it's really going to do is force us to address each other's preconceptions, prejudices, biases. But unless we can actually hear what people are saying, it's very hard to start on that process.
The process has begun. But without better translation tools, supporters of a unified internet worry about separate internets that encourage entirely different narratives and ways of seeing the world. For NPR News, I'm Mark Phillips.
And you can hear a longer version of Mark's story at onthemedia.org.